Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. My name is Nathan Hobson, and today I'm going to be talking with Eiko Marcosinoer about her book, Waste, Consuming Postwar Japan, released by Cornell University Press in 2018. Waste is an absorbing look at the multiple and changing ways that waste of resources, possessions, time, money, etc., has been conceptualized in Japan since 1945. And more than a history of garbage or waste disposal, then, Waste is a look at the aspirations and the discontents of a rapidly changing society, in which waste has been everything from an existential threat in the early post-war period to a critical part of the bright, good life of the affluent and aspirational middle classes. Professor Sinoer is attentive to the socioeconomic context of waste, from the poverty of the first post-war decade to the boom years of the 1960s, and from the traumatic oil shocks of the 1970s to the roaring and opulent bubble years of the 80s, then the post-bubble reckoning with waste in a slow growth era and beyond. The book ranges widely, beginning with early post-war sort of admonitions about against waste, then follows the development of the ideology and economy of leisure and the affluence of the heart, and then tracing both the rise of ecological consciousness and Japan's progressive recycling and solid waste management systems, and then the coming of the post-2000 so-called decluttering movement, peppered throughout with delightful and illustrative examples from period sources, and always conscious of historical continuities and discontinuities, Waste is not just a story about waste consciousness in post-war Japan, but a story about the ways that we make meaning in our lives. Okay, so Dr. Sinoer, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your book, Waste, Consuming Postwar Japan. It's a really fascinating topic, and I'm really curious about how you came to this topic, especially because I think it's a significant departure from some of your earlier work. So can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, so my first book was, as you say, both on a very different kind of topic and was a very different kind of history. It was a kind of political history of modern Japan from the 1860s to the 1960s. And there's a kind of story, I think, to kind of how I came to this topic and this what became a book. I was actually in Tokyo doing research for the first book, actually for my dissertation. When I was living in this kind of neighborhood in Tokyo in a cul-de-sac, which had a rotating garbage duty. So the way that it worked in this particular neighborhood was every week this little kind of plastic slat with all of the names of the families in the cul-de-sac would come around. And when it was your week, it was your responsibility to take care of the area where the garbage is disposed. So, you know, making sure that everything is tidy before garbage pickup and then after the garbage is picked up, to refold the netting that covers the garbage, to kind of, you know, brush away anything that's left and clean everything up. And this happened multiple times a week because there are, you know, separate days for combustible garbage pickup, for non-combustible goods, for plastic recycling, glass recycling, etc. So I had just gotten to Tokyo to start dissertation research, And the first day that it was my turn to do garbage duty, I was very careful about it. I did everything as I was supposed to. But come the second or third day, I'd grown impatient because I wanted to be in the archives and I didn't want to be sitting in my apartment waiting for the garbage truck to come. So I said, okay, I'm going to go out, but I'm going to come back from the archives early so that I can do my garbage duty. But of course, even though I came back early, it was too late. And someone else had already done the cleaning for me. And this became a kind of topic of conversation in the neighborhood, my garbage delinquency. So this started me thinking about all of the kind of social structures that are created around and are assumed by the management of garbage. But I was there to research something completely different. So I just kind of filed this idea away in the back of my head as something that I would return to at some point. So after the first book was out, I came back to this idea of garbage and thought initially that I was going to write a book about the history of garbage from Meiji through the present, from the kind of 1860s through the present. But as I started working through this history of garbage, I couldn't quite figure out how to write a history of garbage that would tell us something about modern Japanese history that we didn't already know or that we aren't already quite familiar with. So kind of narratives about, hygiene and civilization and modernization for the Meiji period, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, how could I do something that's a little bit more new in terms of our ways of thinking about modern Japanese history? And that's when I decided to think a little bit more expansively about waste. So this project that was originally going to be about the history of garbage became and kind of evolved into a history of the idea of waste. And so the waste of not just things, but also resources and time, stuff. And that's where I think I figured that I could say something new about modern Japanese history. And then I also decided to kind of shift the time frame. So not do this kind of large sweep from Meiji into the post-war, which is what I did with the first book, but precisely because I was looking at different kinds of waste, I wanted to kind of be a little bit more focused in the time span. So to do something that was post-war. And I also found this satisfying because I've been hoping that the field has kind of a conversation about the meanings of the post-war and to start to think about the post-war as a kind of cohesive period. So that's kind of how I got to this history of the idea of waste in the post-war.
Yeah, great. And it's something that I think a lot of people, as have a similar sort of experience the first time you move to Japan and come up against the massive social infrastructure that is the neighborhood waste disposal. It really is rather striking. I remember that was, one of my first experiences when I was living on my own for the first time in 1998. And then it's the first sort of avenue for integration into my new neighborhood. I just bought a house here in Nagoya, and it's the uh-huh. It's how you meet the neighbors, even before you go around and, even before you go around and bring little, souvenirs and say, yoroshiku onegai shimasu to everybody in the neighborhood, you meet them out at the trash disposal, right? And very immediately, it's an incredibly intimate sort of experience as well, because you're literally looking through each other's garbage. And it's a huge part of sort of the social structure. And so I'm fascinated, of course, with that aspect on a personal level, but also I thought it was really interesting the way that, and we're going to obviously be talking about this, that you went beyond these sort of questions of simply physical waste into the book. And so that gives us a chance to transition into the book. And so it's laid out in four parts, which are roughly in chronological order. You start off with part one, re-civilization and re-enlightenment. This transitions of the early post-war period, 1945 to 1971. So I'd like to jump into that period and think about the early post-war, starting with chapter one, the imperatives of waste. So you start off this article with this really fascinating example of an article from the women's magazine Fujinkurabu. And I wonder if you could tell us about the article itself, and then how it's representative of the attitudes at the time toward waste and waste management and resource management, and also to what extent this represents a continuity or a discontinuity with wartime and pre-war attitudes.
Yeah, I mean, so this article in Fujinkurabu, or Women's Club, was about how to preserve and cook food that might otherwise be thrown away. And there were quite a few articles like this that were published in the kind of immediate post-war years. You know, articles about, you know, here's how you should boil down, you know, corn cobs to make a kind of sweet syrup, for example, you know, corn syrup. Or here is how you can make edible the tangerine peels that you might otherwise be, you know, throwing away. Or here's how you might pickle the core of the cabbage that otherwise might be thought of as inedible. And so a lot of this was responding to the kind of exigencies of survival in the immediate post-war years. So in a lot of ways, this is not about, you know, here is how you should not waste, or here's what it means to be kind of virtuous and being conscious of waste. It's very much a kind of, here's how not to waste out of necessity. You know, I don't want to say that these articles were representative of attitudes at the time. And I think this is something in the book that I try to be very careful of, which is that a lot of the material that I look at in the book take the form of, you know, advice literature. So advice in newspapers or magazines or books. And so that is, there's that kind of aspirational element to it that doesn't necessarily mean that people were actually doing what was being suggested in the pages. But I think it does reflect at least the kind of understanding on the part of people who were writing these pieces of what they thought would resonate with their readership. And it also reflects the fact that people were actually buying these, you know, magazines, newspapers at the time. So it does suggest something about the reception. But in any case, the Fujinkurabu article does really speak to how the concern was about, for example, with wasting food in this case, the concern was about nutrients. It's certainly not about excess, or, you know, you should just pay attention to waste because that is the kind of ethical and virtuous thing to do. It's about, here is what you need to do to get by. And in that sense, it's a continuity with the wartime period, certainly. This notion of, you know, here is what you could do with your food, for example, so as to survive the kind of hardship of the wartime years, that kind of continues into the immediate post-war. But it's very much a discontinuity with kind of what develops in later decades as these kind of imperatives of, you know, survival start to fade.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that interested me is that you know, this is part of the book that you're referring to, Re-Civilization and Re-Enlightenment, and you have a section in this chapter about the re-civilizing project, which suggests a kind of, you know, both a continuity and a discontinuity in the ways that people were. At least these sort of, you know, educated, the writing class, were looking at these questions about waste and resource management. And you follow that up with this, you know, scientification of daily life, which is actually something that I think, you know, a lot of people talk about in the context of the interwar period as well. So I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about those two sections of the chapter and how they fit into what's being, you know, how waste is being conceptualized, what the consciousness is in the early post-war.
What I was trying to illustrate with this idea of re-civilization and re-enlightenment is obviously, you know, to hark back to those kind of slogans of the early Meiji period, but to emphasize that this was it was not a kind of cycle. It was not kind of going back to the early Meiji period, but kind of post-war variations on these ideas. So, for example, if we think about physical waste, if we think about garbage, the notion of garbage as being somehow backwards that not being able to manage garbage being the sign of a kind of quote unquote uncivilized or, you know, not modern society. You know, those were ideas that were familiar from the Meiji period that then kind of reemerge in the post-war. And then in some ways are kind of intensified by an additional layer of Japan having to kind of rehabilitate itself from the war. So these themes are very much at the forefront when, you know, if we move forward a little bit in time in those years leading up to the Tokyo Olympics in 1964, you know, not only does Japan need to be civilized and modern and properly deal with its human waste and with its garbage, which is why you had all these kind of infrastructure projects, you know, building of sewers and establishment of various systems to manage garbage. But the added kind of layer there was Japan also needed to appear civilized and modern so as to demonstrate that it had kind of, you know, that it could be embraced back into the community of quote-unquote civilized and modern nations after the war. So that's kind of what the themes of re-civilization, re-modernization, what I was trying to get at with that. And then as you were saying, there are other continuities as well from the pre-war period. So this idea of, you know, scientific measurement that makes itself felt in all different areas of life. So, you know, going back to the articles about food waste, one of the themes in a number of those articles was about the importance of measuring. You know, here is, if you have this X amount of flour, here's what you can make from it. Or, you know, if you have this amount of rice, here is how much you should be able to get out of it, and the importance of measuring. So you see it there. But you also see it, you know, as you might expect, in discussions of the factory line and production. So not wasting resources, no extra movements, you know, measuring output, etc. And there's also the kind of household version of that. So, for example, you know, maps of the kind of diagrams of the rural kitchen demonstrating how much inefficiency of movement there was for the rural housewife to have to make a meal. And here is how you could lay out your kitchen in a kind of modern way to make it much more efficient. And so therefore not waste time, movement, you know, energy, effort, etc. And those are all drawing on ideas of kind of scientific management from the interwar period that are kind of brought back into, you know, the post-war as well. So they're in many ways kind of trans-war ideas.
Yeah, and I think that one of the really important points that you sort of make in this, you know, you sort of stake out early in the book is that then this this first post-war decade of, you know, roughly 1945 to 1955 becomes kind of a landmark that gets invoked in later periods with various meanings, you know, either that we ought to follow the good practices, or that aren't we lucky that we don't have to anymore, that, you know, we've sort of moved beyond that. And so it becomes this kind of landmark for the way that post-war Japan then, you know, orients its waste consciousness. And so in that sense, I think it's really interesting that in your second chapter, which treats the second post-war decade of, you know, roughly 1955 on to around that time of the Olympics that you just mentioned, it's actually entitled Better Living Through Consumption. And, you know, it's in the context of the economic recovery and social recovery that's already underway. And you talk about, quote, a middle-class society that valued the consumer being increasingly viewed as the engine of future affluence. But at the same time, because of that, you know, because of the wartime and early post-war experience, there's a lot of anxiety and uncertainty about that that sort of dream, that aspiration. So can you tell us how consumption is reshaped in this new context in the second post-war decade?
Yeah, I mean, as you're suggesting, I think this is a kind of transitional period in the late 50s into the early 60s, where people are starting to ask questions about what kind of consumption is acceptable and desirable. So coming out of the kind of wartime years of, you know, these kind of slogans of luxury is the enemy, etc., What happens when, you know, conditions start to ease such that it is possible to consume more? And in fact, certain people are encouraging you to consume more for the sake of economic growth and economic expansion. So there are a lot of debates about, okay, is it okay to, you know, save up money to spend a lot on, you know, a purchase of a certain good, like an electric good? Is that okay? And what kind of consumption is acceptable? What is too luxurious? What is too extravagant? And I think slowly there starts to be a shift towards kind of conceptions of waste consciousness, shifting to jibe more with the values of mass consumerism as we move kind of further into the 1960s, where then the kind of questions are not just about, you know, is it okay to buy this electric appliance? Is it okay to buy, you know, not just the washing machine, but the black and white television, not just the black and white television, but the color television? But is it also okay to spend money on leisure, for example? So that, you know, what is considered a waste is at first kind of contentious and kind of reflects all the kind of anxieties of the emergence of mass consumerism. But then what is wasteful, what is considered to be wasteful, shifts to accommodate the kind of values and desires of mass consumerism.
Yeah, and so I take it this is sort of what you're referring to as the quote consumption revolution in the 1960s.
Yeah, which is, you know, at the point at which the certain goods, you know, the washing machine, the color television, later the automobile, etc., actually become pretty widely accepted as markers of middle class life that people as consumers should desire to purchase. So a lot of the kind of ambiguity around consumption starts to fade in those kind of years of the consumption revolution. Yeah.
You have one of the things that I really enjoy about the book, obviously, is the, you know, the many anecdotes, but you also have these great little quotes and phrases, you know, one of them being stinginess is a virtue, wasting money is fun, which I think is sort of unthinkable in the first post-war decade. But the fact that this is, you know, already coming up, as you say, in the late 50s and early 1960s is quite striking, really.
Yeah, and there are these kind of great, you know, stories that people have of kind of, you know, what would I do if I could imagine being wasteful? You know, so this from a kind of slightly earlier period, what would be the thing that would be kind of scandalously wasteful? And at first, you know, it's quite modest, like, you know, buying a cigarette and just kind of smoking it a little bit and then just throwing it away without finishing it. Like that would just be the ultimate luxury, which, you know, at a certain period of time would have been the case after, you know, having your kind of makeshift cigarettes during the war, et cetera. You're not going to just throw things out. So this notion that being able to throw something away, that being wasteful was a kind of luxury, and then, dare one say, actually kind of enjoyable.
Yeah, the idea of waste as sort of an aspirational ideal for the bright middle class life that we all lust for is the fact that it comes so quickly. You know, by 1960, you have the Omiyuri running an article, as you have here in the book, you know, is consumption a virtue? Is luxury a virtue? And the answer is, you know, kind of maybe.
Maybe, right, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So something that was unthinkable, you know, a decade earlier becomes like, well, yeah, okay, maybe.
Right. And time. So this is sort of how we, you know, we wind up that first decade in second decade of the post-war. And then, you know, you sort of reach a peak of, you know, Japanese, you know, economic recovery and self-confidence, you know, recovery of self-confidence and status in the world with, you know, as you've mentioned, the 1964 Olympics, the Shinkansen, you have another Olympics that everybody forgets about later in Sapporo, and, you know, and the expo in Osaka in 1970, and Japan's riding very high, you know, despite a certain, you know, the domestic political context, you know, all aside. economically coming out of the 1960s. And then you get into the 1970s, and this is where you take up part two, which I think is rather aptly titled Shocks, Shifts, and Safeguards, Defending Middle Class Lifestyles, 1971 to 1981. And so I guess we need to talk about these shocks and these shifts. And so, you know, we've established, that the middle class lifestyle, you know, includes a certain amount of, pleasurable waste, or at least aspirational waste. But then that comes under a lot of stress in the 1970s. And you start to talk about this in chapter three, Wars Against Waste. And again, you have this fantastic little anecdotal reference at the beginning, which I wonder if you could tell us about. You know, you mentioned the movie Gojira Tai Hedorah, you know, Godzilla versus, was this the smog monster? Was that it? From 1971.
Yeah,
can you tell us about the movie and its significance for sort of understanding a shift in attitudes toward waste and waste consciousness in the 1970s? And then we'll go on to focus on the actual war against waste.
Yeah, so this movie came out in 1971. It's unusual in the Godzilla series, I think, in part because it's got this kind of trippy early 1970s feel to it. And it has a very clear kind of social message. And it's not complicated. It's very straightforward, which is a kind of criticism of environmental degradation. So there are images of industrial pollution, you know, smokestacks that are spewing exhaust. There are these long pans, you know, these long shots of waste of garbage on, you know, the bay floor and or on top, floating on top, you know, glass bottles or television sets in the water, on the surface, you know, sewage and rubber tires and plastic bottles. And all of this as representing the costs of the high growth era. So all of the images of waste and pollution in this Godzilla film reflect this larger realization about the various costs, and in this case, the environmental costs of the high growth era of kind of double digit economic growth. And so I think in that sense is very reflective of this kind of realization in the early 1970s that, you know, resources aren't finite, that what had been fueling, in some ways literally fueling economic growth would not always be so inexpensive, that there have been costs and prices that have been paid to which people had not paid all that much attention until the early 1970s.
Right. And so this comes together with the sort of larger context of the chapter, which is the war against waste, the so-called Gomi Senso of the early 1970s, which gives the chapter its title. So can you tell us specifically about this war against waste, and again, sort of how that dovetails with, you know, what you're seeing in the Godzilla versus the smog monster, and this rising sense of a different kind of anxiety about the costs of waste in the 1970s?
Yeah, in 1971, the governor of Tokyo declares war against waste. He declares and he uses the phrase Gomi Senso. And his main concern, or his primary concern, I should say, was the building of incinerators to deal with what was called the garbage problem. So the garbage problem was multifold. One was just in sheer amount of garbage that was being produced, more so than was able to be dealt with by the kind of current systems, current infrastructure. There was also the issue of more and more plastics in the waste stream. So that was an issue as well. Also more kind of toxic chemicals and things in the waste stream. Also more larger items in the garbage. So, you know, the television sets that people had consumed with such excitement in the previous decade ended up, you know, in the waste stream. And so you have more kind of bulky items in the trash. So there's lots of concern about garbage management in the 1970s. So what the kind of main goal of the Gomi Senso was to site more incinerators in various areas of Tokyo, with the philosophy of, you know, every area of Tokyo managing its own waste. So that was the Gomi Senso. And one of the kind of outcomes of the Gomi Senso is that it made garbage very visible, that there were lots of images of these piles of garbage on city streets. It brought a lot of attention to garbage and physical waste, such that, you know, it made people think more about the kind of end process of mass production and mass consumption, the kind of realization that mass consumption, mass production and mass consumption leads to mass waste. But there were also these larger questions that went along with the garbage war, which was these kind of critiques of high growth, of the high growth era. And so a kind of reconsideration of, you know, what should the goals of, you know, the country really be? Should it be, you know, should it be GDP, or is there something more to keep in mind and to consider when thinking about kind of goals, aspirations of the country going forward? And all of that was compounded by the oil crisis in 1973, which brought a lot of attention to waste of resources, waste of energy, such that all of this, the kind of waste of stuff or the garbage problem, the waste of energy, waste of resources, all really become interwoven as part and parcel of this kind of larger challenges of this moment.
Yeah, and so and that sort of transition, that this shift, as you've called it, in a consciousness about the waste inherent in the high growth system, leads us to, I think, chapter 4, which is called A Bright Stinginess. It's another one of these wonderful phrases that are sprinkled throughout the book. So this idea of a bright kitschy or stinginess, it's such a great phrase. Where does it come from, and sort of what does it mean, and how does it fit into this context of the war against waste and the oil shocks and a sort of shifting consciousness when it comes to the systemic causes and effects of waste?
I came across this phrase, akarui kechi, or bright stinginess, in a roundtable discussion about kechi or stinginess from 1974. It was used by this man named Suzuki Kenji, who was a television announcer for NHK, and he was moderating this roundtable discussion. And he used this phrase, which is such a kind of clever phrase insofar as you've got the kind of idea of brightness or akarui, which really embodied the kind of idea of the kind of bright middle class life, this idea that had been built in a kind of previous decade or so, with the idea of kechi or a kind of stinginess or frugality. And I'm not entirely sure that this particular phrase was that widely used in the 1970s, but for me it really encapsulated a kind of theme and an idea that was articulated with frequency, which was, you know, now that there's been this kind of realization about the finite nature of resources and the sheer amount of stuff that we're throwing away, we need to be more kechi. But this kechi, the stinginess and this frugality, was not in any way supposed to look like the stinginess or frugality of the wartime or immediate post-war years. So kind of this goes back to what you were saying earlier about how those immediate post-war years become this kind of benchmark or this kind of imagined moment in later reincarnations of waste consciousness. And here, the reference to the wartime and immediate post-war is definitely one of, we do not want to go back to that. So hence the akarui part of the akarui kechi, which is, you know, you should be conscious of waste, but that is not to sacrifice. That is not supposed to mean sacrificing the comforts and the conveniences of middle-class life for which people had been striving for many years. So, you know, it's one thing to, you know, turn off the lights in a room if you're not there. You know, it is one thing to, you know, start to kind of these kind of efforts to separate your trash into recyclables and non-recyclables takes off in the 1970s. That's one thing, but those are not considered to be major infringements on, you know, day-to-day life. And so that's the kind of important thing, which is here are some minor things that we can do that are conscious of waste, but don't actually require that much of us. And that will help kind of defend these middle-class lifestyles that have been achieved.
Yeah, and I think this is sort of the, you know, to risk a terrible pun, it's sort of catchiness of catchiness. It's as you put it, moderation rather than abstention, which I think is, you know, again, this one of these wonderful phrases of yours that comes up through the book, this idea that, you know, you can be frugal without sacrificing the comforts of, you know, mass consumption and middle class lifestyle. And this idea of sort of a moderation that allows for progress rather than regression. And this is, again, that sort of, you know, totemic, amuletic invocation of the early post-war as the, you know, the bad old days that we refuse to go back to. And so everything is, you know, sort of oriented toward, you know, moving away from that somehow and never going back in that direction. And yet, you know, and so that even when, you know, waste becomes problematic, we still have to keep moving away from that. Right. Yeah. And so this, this kind of sets up, part three, which is about wealth and its discontent. So part three is called, Abundant Dualities, Wealth and Its Discontents in the 1980s and beyond. And, you know, here we start to see, you begin to reference, in a number of these sort of, phrases like yutori and, you know, monobanare and kokoro no yutakasa and all these sort of Japanese phrases about a kind of affluence of the heart that really becomes the focus of part four. But before we get to that, in part three in chapter five, Consuming Desires, you've already mentioned the idea of, you know, luxury is the enemy, this very, very famous wartime slogan. But you have in one of the figures at the beginning of the chapter, the Isetan Shinjuku department store advertisement, which uses the slogan, luxury is not the enemy, but luxury is splendid. So that instead of zeitaku wa tiki, zeitaku wa sticky, which is, again, a horrible pun, but also one of my favorites. And so can you tell us about how this, you know, suggests this? To me, it sort of suggests a complex interplay between material and spiritual affluence and some continuities and discontinuities with this 1970s context. So can you tell us a little bit about how consciousness of waste in all its forms and what that means for a middle-class lifestyle differs or doesn't differ from the 1970s?
There are certain things that continue from the 1970s. So certain things in terms of, for example, kind of municipal practices of recycling, for example, that were established in the 1970s, those continue into the 1980s. Those, especially in the kind of waste management industry and those who had been especially attuned to issues of waste in the 1970s, those voices continue to exist in the 1980s, but they are much more on the margins. They are not central in mainstream in discussions about waste consciousness as they had been in the 1970s. So there's very much an attenuation of waste consciousness in the 1970s, as you might expect. when it comes to, you know, we kind of think about the 1980s as this kind of epitome of materialism and mass consumption, and in many ways that's not untrue. And there is this kind of weakening of waste consciousness in the 1980s. So, you know, things like phrases that you mentioned, like monobara or kind of separation from things, for example. I mean, a lot of this is just they're just marketing slogans, which are in fact intended to encourage consumption. So maybe you're not explicitly told to spend money on stuff. In some cases, you know, there's kind of, you know, advertisements to spend on services instead or on leisure. But also spending on leisure also then, you know, when you need all this like equipment and accoutrement for your various hobbies is also all about consumption. So there's a way in which this notion of an affluent heart that's used or kind of, you know, certain separation from things is really just in many cases, a marketing slogan to encourage consumption.
Yeah, my daughter has a bento box that says something. It's in some sort of fake French, I believe, that says something like, you know, true happiness is being happy with the things you have, not buying more stuff. And it seems to me that there's a certain resonance with that sort of marketing that I'm seeing here in the 1980s. In the way that you're describing this sort of, you know, consuming desires.
Yeah. But I think also there starts to be, and this I talk about in the kind of next chapter, in chapter six, there starts to be the kind of seeds of really thinking about this idea of an affluent heart in a more sincere way, and not just as a kind of, you know, cynical marketing ploy, but actually thinking about what makes for a good life and what makes for a happy life. And is it really necessary to have all this stuff in order to, you know, feel contented? And I think that taps into this kind of dissatisfaction in the 1980s, which was, you know, we were supposed to be working so hard, first for kind of economic reconstruction, then economic growth. And in the 1980s, when it seems like we should have arrived, life doesn't feel like it was supposed to feel, you know, as we were kind of promised, that there's not an abundance of time to do with as you want. There, you know, things don't actually feel so comfortable. There doesn't seem to be a kind of, you know, this sense of relaxation that people had been promised. So those conversations do start to happen in the 1980s, this kind of rethinking about, well, what is it that affluence is supposed to mean?
Right. And so you talk about, you really tackle those themes in detail in chapters 6 and 7. So actually, let's move on to chapter 6, which is, appropriately titled Living the Good Life with a question mark at the end. And to me, I think this is, you know, really well, again, introduced with this anecdote about the 1978 opening of the Island of Dreams Park, or Yubenoshima, in former landfill number 14, which again, just the irony kills me, but, in Tokyo. So can you tell us a little bit about the park itself and why it's illustrative of this sort of trend toward thinking about the good life in a different way in the 1980s? And in particular, it is a leisure facility, and sort of how then leisure fits into questions about waste and waste consciousness in the sort of, you know, as you've said, the sort of the opulent 80s.
Yeah, the Island of Dreams Park, Yumenoshima, is a huge area which now has, you know, playing fields, like a soccer field, and then it has a facility that has all kinds of opportunities for recreation and leisure. I don't even recall the various courts that are in there and various things. But it's a huge facility, which if you go to it now, it's very striking, because if you think of this area as having once been landfill, or kind of the landfill that is now under your feet, you do get a sense of the scale of the landfill and the sheer amount of stuff that had been thrown away. And I talk about it in this kind of metaphorical sense, insofar as, you know, the trash being kind of literally underground and out of sight, and upon it is constructed something that is meant to encourage recreation, leisure, enjoyment of time. And I do think that there starts to be, I shouldn't say starts to be, but there is kind of a tension in the 1980s to, you know, free time not being an unproductive waste, but actually something that is desirable and something necessary for yutori, or a sense of, you know, relaxation or ease. And so, you know, whereas in decades past, unproductive time might have been considered to be a waste of time, here, the notion that free time is not a waste just because it might not be so productive starts to kind of come into circulation, which is also a kind of response to attention at this moment to overwork, you know, and exhaustion, and so on. And so, you know, for example, there's a comic that comes out in the 1980s, Dai Tokyo Bimbo Seikatsu Monogatari, I think, if I recall correctly, where the main character doesn't have a regular job. He does things, you know, kind of odds and ends occasionally to make money to get by. But he's intentionally not a sarariman, even though he graduated from, you know, first-rate university. He's chosen to live in a very small apartment with very few things. And what he does with his time is he sits around. You know, he'll read a little bit. He'll talk with his friends. But just kind of sitting there and not doing anything that might be construed as productive is modeled here as something that might actually be desirable, at least something to think about.
Right. And this, Dai Tokyo Bimbo Seikatsu Manual, the manual for living poor in Greater Tokyo, you do, again, have a figure from there that, you know, talks about the undesirability of wartime poverty. And again, it's sort of being invoked as that thing that, you know, we don't want to go back to. And that, you know, it's sort of interesting to me, the furita, you know, the free timer as hero. I didn't realize that this was, you know, sort of a thing, so to speak, as early as the 1980s. And it was quite a revelation for me, that, you know, even if that's, you know, something a little bit satirical, a little bit aspirational. The fact that this is even sort of being, you know, bandied around and tossed around in this way in the 1980s was somewhat surprising to me.
Yeah, and this is actually a different, in some ways, a different meaning of furita than the one that develops in later years that comes out of economic insecurity. Here, it is a kind of a decision about employment and lifestyle by choice. So the character here has decided to be a furita, which again is different from the furita of later years. It is also different, as you were saying, from the wartime and immediate post-war years, which is this is a poverty, a kind of quote-unquote poverty by choice. And that's what makes all the difference, is the kind of deliberate decision and to be in a position to make the deliberate decision to live in this way.
So this question of time and wasting of time, clearly, you know, it's a big part of the sort of changing perceptions of leisure and the value of leisure and time and a sort of affluence of the heart, the yutori question. But it comes up in a somewhat more literal sense in chapter 7, which is called Battling the Time Thieves. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about this. You know, it's continuing this discussion that you're having about the about leisure and about questions of time. But you start us off with the great reception in Japan of the novel by Michael Ende, the German novelist who wrote Neverending Story, if I remember right, as well. Momo, the mysterious story of the time thieves and the girl who brought the stolen time back to the people. And this came out in Japanese translation in 1983, I guess it was.
1976.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
Yeah.
So it came out in the 1970s and it had an enormously good reception in Japan, which you suggest is indicative of concerns about time and about the sort of use and waste of time in Japan. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, the book comes out in translation in 1976, but it really becomes popular in the 1980s. And the kind of antagonists in the novel are the kind of time thieves, who are these men who are all dressed all in gray. They wear these suits and bowler hats. And in essence, they steal people's time. So they go around and ask people, well, how are you using your time? Well, clearly it's a waste to, for example, you know, be dating this woman that you don't intend to marry, for example, or spending too much time with your pet parakeet, or, you know, whatever it might be, these things that are deemed not productive. And what happens, apparently what is happening, is that these time thieves are then convincing people to deposit this quote unquote wasted time into a time saving bank. And it is off the time that is in the bank that these men in gray, these time thieves, live. And they're juxtaposed against the kind of protagonist in the novel, which is really a children's book, although it was widely read by adults as well. So the protagonist, Momo, who has no sense of a commodified notion of time or precise measurement of time. She's this kind of young girl who is known for, you know, listening carefully to her friends and spending time with them. And so is not at all beholden to these kind of systems of measurement and commodification when it comes to time or anything else for that matter, stuff either. So there are these two very different notions of time that come into conflict with a kind of clear criticism of the notion of time being treated as money. And in the kind of commentary about Momo in the 1980s and beyond, there's a lot of resonance with this idea of, you know, people have been too concerned with measuring time, have been too concerned with this notion of time having to be productive, that perhaps, you know, notions of well-being or the good life should not be based on these kind of notions of wasted time as they have been defined, but to think more capaciously or at least differently about how time should be, I was going to say how time should be spent, but even that very language is a kind of, you know, using the same language of money for time, but, you know, thinking not of time in terms of something that can be measured, commodified, spent.
Yeah, and it seems to me that, you know, your argument is that in the 80s, this is, you know, a response to some extent, you know, it's a sort of sense of crisis about the ways in which we've lost the ability to use our time freely and without constraints and without the sort of, you know, the sort of Damocles, you know, made by Taylorism sort of hanging over our head and, you know, making us overly self-conscious. And then, and this brings us, you know, into this, the last part of the book, which is Affluence of the Heart, Identities and Values in the Slow Growth Era, 1991 to the present. Because it seems to me that, you know, here, this, again, this question of that you're talking about in terms of leisure and time in chapters 6 and 7 in part 3, then take on a different sort of valence, a different kind of value and nuance in the 1990s, which you refer to as, it's a great phrase, the unsettled years. And so this seems to me to be that our notions of leisure and time and are disrupted again in certain ways. And that it's reflected in changing waste consciousness. In other words, so the question I want to ask is then, how did waste consciousness change in the slow burn of the post-bubble 1990s?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the 1990s, in some ways, there was much that was the same in terms of waste consciousness. That is a kind of attention to waste of resources and energy, you know, the calls for recycling and reuse. Plus, you know, that still waste consciousness was not to mean sacrificing comfort and convenience. All of those ideas, especially from the 70s, if a bit muted in the 1980s, are still there in the 1990s and more so in the 1990s than they had been in the immediate previous decade. But the framing starts to be more in terms of a kind of global environmental consciousness, I think. Whereas, you know, there had been an attention to the environment in the 1970s. It tended to be a little bit more anthropocentric. But in the 1990s, the vision is kind of more outward looking. It is more global. And also that environmentalism becomes more a kind of good in itself than I think it was in the 1970s. So there's more of a kind of ecological mindset. So, for example, you see more in the 1990s the idea of green consumption, you know, ecologically minded ways or things to consume is something that you see in the 1990s. So many of the similar ideas, especially from the 1970s, that are reframed in these terms of a kind of befitting a global environmental age.
Yeah, one of the things that you talk about in Chapter 8, Greening Consciousness, is that 1989 is seen by some as sort of year one, you know, the zero year, I guess, of a global environmental age. And, you know, as you said, I mean, you already have a sort of the beginning of recycling programs in the 1970s and, you know, a fairly strong sense of the sort of the problems of material waste. So what's changing, and why is it that people see, you know, the 1990s essentially as the dawning of this global environmental age in Japan? And how does that sort of play out in the everyday life of people in the 1990s?
Yeah, and I think, you know, in part it's because Japan was a participant in what was a kind of global environmental moment. So I think that shaped a lot of the kind of discourse about environmental consciousness in Japan in the late 1980s and into the 1990s. So, you know, 1988 was the year that Japan's environmental agency actually articulated a commitment to dealing with global warming. That was also the year when Japan became a member of the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change. You know, in 1989, you have the Tokyo Conference on Global Environmental Protection, the position of Global Environmental Minister, and the Ministerial Council on Global Environmental Protection. Those are established in 1989, actually set goals for, you know, limiting carbon dioxide emissions. So this was kind of at the national level a commitment. So I think that is partially, or maybe more than partially, in large part helps shape the kind of discourse about waste consciousness into the 1990s.
Yeah, and so this is, I think, where you get the in some sense where you get the title of Chapter 9. We are all waste conscious now, which I think is a really you know, my first engagement with Japan came in the 1990s, and I certainly had that feeling again, particularly coming from the United States, that gee, everybody is waste conscious here. One of the key words that you engage with in Chapter 9 is mottainai. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the word, where it comes from, and also how it's mobilized in the 1990s and 2000s. And again, you have this great example of the picture book, the children's picture book, Mottainai Basan, which I will admit I read to my children when they were small. it reminds me a little bit of a sort of like Oshin from the 1980s, you know, this sort of homage to an earlier, more virtuous generation of women as sort of moral leaders in, you know, showing our way forward. But can you tell us a little bit about the word Mottainai, where it comes from, how it's mobilized in books like Mottainai Basan, and maybe a little bit about the book itself, if you'd like.
Yeah, so the word Mottainai, which I translate as kind of wasteful or kind of how wasteful, like how Mottainai, there's a real boom in the use of the word in the 2000s. In fact, was labeled by some as a Mottainai boom. And there was in 2004, that was the year that the first Mottainai Basan, or maybe No Waste Grandma, book was published. And Mottainai Basan, as you're saying, is very important that she is grandma, which is that she is clearly of the wartime generation. And this is where I think what we've been saying about the ways in which those immediate, you know, the wartime and immediate post-war years get constructed later on in the post-war years, that's really where this comes into play, where Mottainai Basan is constructed here as embodying the waste conscious virtues of that previous wartime generation. And there's a kind of real nostalgia for this era where Japan was said to be waste conscious. Now, what's totally forgotten in this nostalgia is that people were not just choosing to be waste conscious, but this was a kind of waste consciousness of choice, not of choice, right, but of survival and the exigencies of the time. And that is completely forgotten. So you have Mottainai Basan, who kind of descends on her young grandson and his mother, who's also clearly born in the post-war, who lapse into wasteful ways of various kinds. So, you know, taking more food at a buffet than they can eat, for example. You know, who keep the water running when they're brushing their teeth. But also, I think what's captured by the idea of motainai is that it is not just about kind of specific kind of concrete things in terms of wastefulness, but also things like it's wasteful to videotape or take photos at a sporting match rather than actually kind of immersing yourself in the moment and enjoying, you know, the camaraderie and the teamwork, like actually enjoying the sporting match, that is also considered to be motainai. Or it's motainai to just look at the autumn leaves without actually kind of playing with them and playing in them. So motainai becomes very, very expansive. It's not just strictly the waste of resources or energy or things. It's also just thinking about, I mean, in some ways, it goes back to this idea of this affluence of the heart about enjoyment and pleasure and happiness.
Yeah, and I think one of the really things that was that really struck me about you know, thinking about motainai basan, the book and the character, is the focus on children, which you touch on in a number of ways in this chapter. In terms of outreach to children, educational outreach, and I certainly I notice I have kids in public school here in Nawe, and I notice this here, traveling to the waste the water treatment plant as part of a school trip, and I noticed that one of the things that you talk about in the chapter is your own tour of an incineration plant. Can you tell us about that? Because I thought that was a really a fascinating anecdote that you have. And I think it says a lot about the changing ways that the public is being engaged in thinking about waste.
Yeah, so I took this tour of an incineration plant in Tokyo, which actually sits next to the Island of Dreams Park. And actually it provides a lot of the electricity for things that happen at the Island of Dreams Park, it heats the pool and that kind of thing. So one of the things that surprised me about the tour was, it starts with this kind of video that you're shown, and this video is clearly not intended for adults. it's got a little quiz section. It's got animated characters. And so I asked about this because I had first come across the idea of touring incineration plants in my research on the 1970s, where it was mainly housewives who were encouraged to tour incineration plants as a way of convincing housewives that these were modern, scientific, safe, healthy, plants. And so that, you shouldn't balk at the idea of having one in your neighborhood. And this is part of, the kind of war on garbage and the push to build more incinerators. And here, this was something quite different. And so it was, as you say, aimed at elementary school students, fourth graders in particular, who are all required to visit an incineration facility. So they also, showed me things that they hand out to the school kids when they visit. Things like, toys, like a kaleidoscope made out of recycled incinerator ash. There's also the attempt to make the incinerator feel, or the plant feel more cute, approachable. Every incinerator in Tokyo apparently has a mascot. This one, because it's located by the water, the mascot for this particular one was Rui, the dolphin, who is very cute. So the audience, as you say, had shifted clearly to being about children. Also, what struck me was the sense of running out of space did not actually seem as dire as it had been articulated in the 1970s, which is the byproduct of the incineration process, this kind of ash. because there has been technological development and things that can be done with the ash, making certain kinds of concrete, using it for construction, et cetera, that there's still, you know, there's still running out of space, but it is not happening at the kind of alarming rate as it was experienced in the 1970s. So that struck me as well.
Yeah. So I think I want to jump onto the last chapter here, and just to look back a second. I mean, I think that in chapters 8 and 9, in chapter 8, you talk about a sort of an opening outward, thinking about the earth, the environment, and ecology, and then in chapter 10, there's this sort of branding of an ecologically sensitive and progressive Japanese lifestyle that's part of a cool Japan kind of approach to Japanese soft power in the world. And then in chapter 10, sorting things out, you suggest that things are a little bit different. With this new move to decluttering or danshari. And of course, now media and social media tells me that we are living in the age of Maria Kondo's series as the number one thing on Netflix. I wonder if, I hate to ask, but I wonder if you have anything to say about that as well. But if you could tell us a little bit about the sort of shift from an outward focus on the world and on, in terms of ecology and also in terms of, sort of a coup de Japan approach to soft power, and then an inward sort of turn with danshari, this idea of decluttering. And then if you feel that you need to comment on Marie Kondo, please feel free to do so.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's a shift so much as the kind of layering of different ways of thinking about wastefulness. So, I think this idea of motainai continues later into the 2000s, arguably to the present. The kind of motainai campaign that you referenced, which was a campaign launched by the Mainichi Newspapers Company and the Tochu Corporation, that continues. So that idea of motainai, which is fairly expansive but also environmentally focused, that continues. But at the same time, there's been this kind of, in some cases, explicit pushback against motainai by people who are writing in this decluttering vein. So this kind of literature about, getting rid of excess stuff and organizing your space. Kondo Marie, her book, her first book came out in Japanese in 2011. She is, in some ways, very different from the motainai folks, insofar as, she explicitly says this sense of guilt for throwing things away is an obstacle to cleaning your space. So you need to get over this sense of motainai. She is not very concerned with the garbage produced by her decluttering method. She doesn't speak so much about what you're supposed to do with this stuff that you're throwing out. So what she is concerned about is your kind of, the kind of affective self, about what is bringing you joy. So, I don't think that I need to explain now since people seem so familiar with her, but the heart of her method is, you're supposed to pick up a thing. If it brings you joy, then you keep it. If it doesn't bring you joy, you throw it out. So this is very much at odds with the motainai idea. It doesn't have an environmental consciousness dimension to it. It's unconcerned with what you do with the stuff once you throw it away. It is, and in addition to that, I would say it's not a critique of consumption. It doesn't make you actually think that much about consumption. And it is very centered not just on what makes you happy, but also on things and the relationship that you have with things. So it's very stuff-centered, actually. So I think in some ways, there's a similarity to the motainai insofar as this notion of what brings you joy or what makes you happy, that is shared, I think, between the kind of decluttering people and the motainai people. But in the ways that they think about the environment, to some extent about consumption, certainly about garbage production, motainai and decluttering are quite different.
Yeah, and I think it's also sort of, it interests me that, you know, Kondo Maria is now something of, in a strange way, a cultural ambassador for this cool Japan kind of lifestyle exportation that you touch on in chapter 9, that, you know, in a weird way, both positively and negatively, and I see that there's, you know, a significant divergence in the way that people feel about her show and her methodology. But it seems to me that it is part of a sense that, you know, of a sort of Japanese lifestyle as a kind of vanguard in thinking about our relationship to things, for better and for worse.
Yeah, I think that she has done a tremendous job of marketing herself because, you know, many of her ideas, they're not new. Certainly some of the concrete suggestions that she has, the ideas like, you know, everything should have a designated place so you'll know what to find it. That is familiar from the kind of Taylorite literature of the interwar years, right? She has done a wonderful job of marketing herself. And I think also, you know, has a kind of well-polished message that really resonates with this kind of current moment of kind of searching for some kind of meaning, I think, but is problematic insofar as it promotes this kind of image of Japanese people and Japanese families living in these quasi-minimalist, very organized homes. whereas I would say the reasons why Kondo Maria is popular in Japan and in the United States and in Germany and various places are the same, which is that is in this kind of, you know, relatively affluent first world societies, the shared problem of having an excess of stuff is what is driving her popularity. It is not that, yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. I mean, I think she's very much in that sense. It reminds me of the old misunderstanding of the old saying, you know, "Deru kugi wa utareru," the nail that sticks up gets hammered down. You know, you wouldn't say that if there weren't so damned many nails sticking up all over the place. And it's not that Japan hammers down all the nails. It's just sort of, you know, the fact is that there are nails sticking up all over the place. And, you know, Kondo Maria could not be popular if we all lived in the minimalist, decluttered world that she sort of suggests, you know, that particularly Japan, that she's not representative in that sense of a lived reality in Japan so much as an aspirational ideal for the way that we organize our built and lived environment. Yeah,
and an aspirational ideal just as aspirational in Japan as in the United States.
Yeah, exactly.
And elsewhere.
So that's sort of a strange place to talk about your book, and I apologize for having dragged you into the world of Netflix and its cultural politics. But I do want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today about your book. I look forward to having a chance to talk to you again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.